So we are up to page 1270. I think the last thing we saw verse 12, chapter 2, verse 12. So now we'll move on to verse 13, and this is Ruth responding to Boaz. So just to put us back into context where we are in the story, Ruth had come to Boaz's field. Unbeknownst to her, he happened to be a very wealthy person, a righteous person, the Gadol Hador, and a relative. She didn't even know this. And Boaz spotted her, gave her the royal treatment, really cared for her, told her, please stay in my field, collect as you need, I'll take care of you. And she saw, and he didn't, because he knew about her. Her story was famous. He knew about what she had done to leave her nation, accompany her mother-in-law, come to Eretz Yisrael. And he wanted to reward her for that because she's such a special, righteous woman. So at that, Ruth didn't really respond in any way. I'm so great. I did such an amazing thing. Ruth is very, very modest, very humble. And we see here in verse 13, she says, then she said, may I continue to find favor in your eyes, my Lord, because you have comforted me, and because you have spoken to the heart of your maidservant, although I am not even as worthy as one of your maidservants. So after all of this, Ruth sees herself as being no more worthy than anybody else. So Boaz has given her the royal treatment and the royal speech, and given her such great respect. But yet she says, you know, I've done what I'm supposed to do. She doesn't see herself as being so great, so out of the ordinary. She thinks that she is just a regular, everyday person who has made the right decision to do the right thing. That's all she feels. That's verse 13. Now let's move to verse 14. At mealtime, Boaz said to her, come over here and partake of the bread and dip your morsel in the vinegar. So she sat beside the harvesters. He handed her parched grain, and she ate and she was satisfied and had some leftover. So there's actually a lot contained in this short pasuk, in pasuk Yudalad, verse 14. Boaz understands that Ruth is somebody who will lead to greatness. She is great and will produce greatness. And in this conversation, we see a lot about Boaz and a lot about Ruth. So let's take it piece by piece. Number one, what he tells her, he says, come sit over here and partake of the bread. Where'd she sit? She sat beside the harvesters. So Boaz invited her, come sit front and center. Come sit over here with me. I want to give you the most honorable seat in the house. And Ruth, not only did she sit with the harvesters, she's on the side. She wants to stay off in the corner, do her own thing. She didn't want to get involved in the limelight. She didn't want to be given that respect. So we see again her humility. It's pointed out the term used in the Hebrew here is goshi halom. Mm-hmm. Goshi halom is a rare term used throughout Tanakh. The term halom means over here, mm-hmm. but it's not used very often.
Never.
And the Medrash points out that halom is used really only in conjunction with royalty. Mm-hmm. It's a term we find used by several kings. It says the word halom, referring to kings. And here we see.
Any chance one example, or you could not?
Find I don't have off. I mean, you can look it up. I don't have it offhand.
Okay.
Unless it's here in this paper, I don't think it is.
It's very unusual.
It's unusual, yeah. But it's used in terms of kings. Uh-huh. And over here, Boaz was giving Ruth this reference that you are going to lead to royalty. I foresee in your future you're going to give birth to the royal dynasty of David HaMelech. Uh-huh. So he already calls her when she's just a very fresh Moabite convert with this term halom, mm-hmm. implying to her that recognize how great you are. You're going to lead to greatness.
How does he know? I mean, is he a Navi?
He's a Shofi. I don't know if he was a Navi.
Yes, how does he know that she will?
He did a Ruach HaKodesh. Different than Nevuah. But there's a certain insight that a great Gadol can have to see greatness in a person. So he has this term, Goshi Halom, to make her understand that you are destined for royalty.
Could it be that she was royalty already?
That's true. That's a good point.
Yeah.
The question would be, does he know that? Maybe he does, maybe he doesn't. That's a good point. Very possible. Very possible. And then he tells her, he tells her, eat from the bread and dip your bread in vinegar. Mm-hmm. So vinegar is something which is sour, very tart. And Chazal here in the Medrash, they point out that he's actually referring here to some of her wicked grandchildren that come out of her. You're going to have grandchildren that are going to be like vinegar, mm-hmm. Namely Menashe.
You know, like Rechavam.
Menashe was the one they're really focusing on. You know, Menashe was probably the most evil of all of the kings of Malchus Yehuda, of the tribe of Judah, of the nation of Judah, of the land of Judah. Mm-hmm. Menashe is somebody who reigned for over 50 years, and 55 years I think it was. He's somebody who caused many, many Jews to do avodah zarah, to serve idols, to do terrible, terrible things. He himself performed every sin under the sun. A terrible, terrible person. And yet Boaz, at this point, where he's giving her such kavod, such honor, for some reason alludes to this terrible, wicked Menashe. And the question is, what kind of encouragement is that? You're telling me I'm a great person, I'm going to have great kings come out of me, and this terrible, despicable, wicked king? Like, why are you alluding to him at this moment? And that's a question, obviously, we have to address. So, what kind of, is this something that's just a positive thing to Rus? This seems to be a very negative thing. So one comment, it's a hard thing to answer exactly why this is. One comment I saw, which helps us understand why this is actually a positive reference, is that Menashe is not as wicked as we think. Menashe, we actually spoke about this a while back. He did tshuva at the end of his life. That's number one. He did do tshuva. He repented, despite all of the evil deeds that he did. That's clear. You find that in Divrei Yomim, in the book of Divrei Yomim. But number two, Menashe, we find in the Gemara, is portrayed as somebody who is actually somewhat of a what do you call him? He himself is a paradox in a certain sense, because on the one hand, he's a terribly wicked person. On the other hand, the Gemara tells a story that one time the great Ravashi was one who compiled the Gemara. Ravashi was speaking in his shir, and he said, "Tomorrow I'm going to discuss my friend Menashe." And that night, Menashe comes to him in a dream.
Wow.
And Menashe says, "I'm your friend? You think I'm your friend?" And they start speaking about some intricate words of Torah. They're talking and learning about halacha.
Yeah.
And Menashe knows far more than Ravashi knows about halacha. Menashe tells Ravashi, so he says, "I'm your friend? I'm your Rebbe. I'm much greater than you." So Ravashi asks Menashe, he says, "Well, if that's the case, then why did you do such terrible things? Obviously, you're a big Talmud Chacham. You know lots of Torah. So why were you involved in such terrible sins, idolatry?" So Menashe tells Ravashi, he says, "Ravashi, if you were there with us at the time, you would roll up your sleeves and run after the idols with me." That's what he tells him. Which is not my topic today, but the point being made is that we can't relate to the lust, the desire they had for idolatry. The Gemara tells us that urge was taken away from the world at a certain point. And in those times, you read Tanakh, and they're constantly pursuing idols, worshipping idols, bowing to idols, and you wonder, like, that's not such a big challenge for us. But you have these great people throughout Tanakh constantly challenged by idolatry. And the answer is Hashem took away that challenge. We couldn't handle the challenge. It was such a terrible challenge. But the story for our purpose right now, Shul Menashe was not, in his essence, a terrible, horrible, wicked heretic. He was somebody that was on a very high level. He knew a lot of Torah. He just had a terribly difficult challenge, which everyone had at the time. And he failed at his challenge. But the point being made over here is that Boaz tells Rus, "You're going to have a terrible, wicked child. But recognize the fact that you're Jewish means that even though on the surface he's wicked, on the inside there's still a lot of good to him. Mm-hmm. He does tshuva at the end of his life. He has the neshama within, which is purely good. He's somebody who knows Torah. And this is actually a consolation to her, because if she is concerned about wicked grandchildren, the answer is, even those who are wicked have something, there's a redeemable quality within. There's something within them which is positive, which is pure, which has this holiness, which you wouldn't have had you remained a Moabite." You find a very similar reference when Yaakov comes into Yitzchak. Yitzchak wants to give the brachos to his children. And Yaakov has to pretend he's Esav. So he wears Esav's clothing. And he walks into the room, and Yitzchak says that Reach Bani, the smell of my child, is Kareach Hagan Asher Bercho Hashem. It's like the smell of Sadeh Asher Bercho Hashem. It's like the smell of the field that Hashem has blessed. And the Medrash says on that, it says, don't read it Reach Begadav. Don't say it's the aroma of the clothing. Say Reach, this is the Reach of the Bogdim. It's the aroma of those who are traitors. And on that, the Gemara gives examples of people, of Jewish people who are traitors, but have within them good. And the point is that every single Jew has good within, despite the fact on the outside they look like they're treacherous. So it's not Reach Begadav, it's Reach Bogdav. There's a special aroma even to the traitors of Klal Yisrael. So even the wicked people who are Jewish, deep down, there's something there which is positive. And we have to be able to bring it out, and they have to be able to overcome these external layers of sin, which have totally enveloped them. But if you can see within, once you're Jewish, the neshama within always has good to offer. If we can just dig in and find it, then we see the good.
Rabbi, are you saying that he explained to Ruth about Menashe and her future offspring? by just saying the Tavar Piter Bachometz?
Well, again, the Ruach HaKodesh implied it.
But he shared that with her?
I don't know if did she understand or not. That's a good question.
Right.
But the very fact that he told her this idea about dipping in vinegar, that in Ruach HaKodesh was alluding to this idea.
Yeah.
Right.
But
I don't know if she understood the reference or not. I'm not sure.
No. Rabbi, yeah. I want to ask you what you said about Menashe. Is it any places in the Melachim which said that he was a big Talmid Chochem or in Divrei Hayamim? Did we have any note that he was learned man?
Not in Melachim
not
in Divrei Hayamim. We know he did tshuva. We know he did tshuva in Divrei Hayamim. It says that he says he did tshuva. We don't know if he's the Talmid Chochem. But the truth is, if we're dealing with the dynasty of David HaMelech, uh-huh. These are very, very, these people Hashem chose through a Nevuah to become the kings of Klal Yisrael. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about these just like lowly, wicked people. These are very, very big people who had to deal with very, very big challenges. And that's something, as you learn through Tanakh, it's important to take that perspective into account. Because if we look at them like just like ourselves, then we can't understand what they're doing. We don't understand, how could he be so wicked? But the truth is that the world was different. And they're on a very high level, and therefore their challenges are very, very difficult.
No, this I know, yeah. That the Hashem took from us the will, the desire to build
right.
Kodah Zarah. We always did.
Right.
Yeah.
But I don't think there's any reference in a pasuk that he was a Talmud Chacham.
So you want to tell me that also Malchei Israel, Yerovam ben Nevat, and all this also had some Jewishness in them?
I would say so, for sure.
Even the people from Malchei Israel who build Agalim not to go to
they were also chosen through Nevuah, and it's, I think so. I would think so. Okay. We just don't understand the challenges they went through. So we can't, that's why we can't understand the wicked acts that they did. Mm-hmm. They would do things far beyond that we'd ever dream of doing, the Averas that they did,
okay.
But it's because of who they were. So that's this idea of the vinegar, based on what Chazal tells us.
I think Rashi said the vinegar is when it's very hot, it's good to eat vinegar. I think, if I remember from years ago,
yeah.
You eat vinegar in a hot day.
Yeah, yeah, right, yeah, right, correct, yeah.
Correct?
It pulls you down, yes, correct, yeah, it says that, it does say that. And then it says, yeah, he was an example, right, Riach Bogdav, right, yes, correct. Right. But what Zvi's pointing out is the story of the traitor, which Chazal point out, is that the Romans were looking for a Jew to go into this mikdash and take out all the different, the menorah and the kelim. And no Jew would dare go that far to be such a traitor, except there was one Jew named Yosef Meshisa who said, I'll go in. Mm. And he went in and he brought out the menorah, I think. And the Romans said, hey, that's nice, we'll take that one, you go in and take something else. And he said, you know, it's enough for me that I've angered Hashem one time, I'm not doing it again. Mm-hmm. And the Gemara points out that even though he was a traitor, you know, there was a certain line he wouldn't cross. And he felt the guilt, he felt the shame, and he wouldn't go back in. So that's the story he's pointing out.
Yes.
The pasuk then at the end says, he handed her parched grain, and she ate and was satisfied and had some leftover. So there's another medrash on this, another very what I find to be a very inspirational medrash. Because it's funny, like if Boaz wants to give her this royal treatment, he's telling her about these great things that she's going to be destined for, he wants to care for her because she's poor and she's hungry, all he gave her was some parched grain, which is a very simple meal. He could have given her a much nicer, larger, substantial meal. So the first thing that the Medrash tells us is that the food was blessed, and even though it was only a small amount, she was satisfied. That's number one. But then it says, this is the part which I find very inspirational, it says, Amar Rav Yitzchak Bar Marion. Rav Yitzchak Bar Marion said that the Ba Pasuk Lamdecha, the Pasuk is coming to teach us, Shim Adam Osem Mitzvah. If someone does a mitzvah, Yasena Belevav Shalom, do it with a full heart, with full devotion and full intent. Why? Because if Reuven knew that Hashem was writing in the Torah, Vishma Reuven Yatzilim Yadam, when Reuven came and he saved Yosef, he said, don't kill Yosef, let's throw him in a pit. Right? No, don't kill him on the spot. So when Reuven did this, it says that had he realized the Torah was recording that conversation, he would have picked him up on his shoulders and run him back to Yaakov. That's what it says. And if Aaron knew that Hashem is writing in the Torah, that he was coming out to greet Moshe. Moshe was in the land of Midian. He was on his way back to redeem Klal Yisrael. And Moshe was a little bit concerned that Aaron would be jealous. So Aaron was not jealous. He came out and he greeted Moshe and he gave him a kiss. Mm-hmm. But had he known that Hashem was recording that Torah, Aaron would have come out and greeted him with a band, with a whole parade. They would have made a much bigger deal out of it. And if Boaz knew that Hashem was writing down in the Megillah that he was giving Rus just some toasted grain and she'd be satisfied, he would have fed her a golos mefutamos, big fatty steaks. He would have fed her. Right? Calves. So that's what the Medrash says. So what does this mean? It means that they were so shallow, if they knew it was being publicized, they would have done a better job? Like, that sounds like a funny thing to point out over here. And the real understanding, I think, is the following. That people don't realize the power of their actions. We're talking here about three very, very important points in Jewish history. And these people did great things. All three of them did something which is a very, very important heroic effort in a certain sense. They're doing great things in order to bring about redemption for Klal Yisrael, to save lives, to bring us out of Mitzrayim, to create the Mashiach. But they didn't realize it at the time. You know, Aaron just thought, okay, this is my brother, I'm going to go greet him. And Reuven thought, I'm going to do the right thing. I have to save him, so you know, I'm going to save him from death. And Boaz said, I'm taking care of this noble, poor convert. But had he, and what they did was fine, and what they did was successful in terms of what happened. But had they realized the importance of these deeds, had they known the impact these deeds would have on the future, on all generations, they would have done it in a much more sincere and, you know, grand, focused way, because they realized they're creating history. And that's what they missed out on. They didn't know what they were doing was creating history. They thought what they were doing was simple, everyday actions. So it's something which applies to us very much. You know, we don't know which actions of ours create history. You know, every single person has a role in this world. Any small action done might be the key to bringing Mashiach, might be the key to saving a life, might be the key to bringing somebody a refuah, might be the key to mending a relationship. Little things that we do might be the key to building a community. We don't know what our actions do. Maybe one action is going to influence a person for the good. Without that, they wouldn't have done what they did. And the truth is, you know, after 120 years, we'll go up to Shemayim, and Hashem will show us a list. Look at all that you accomplished. And I'll say, I didn't do that. He'll say, yeah, because you did that small action, and it impacted hundreds of people. And you're going to see that you accomplished much more than you ever thought. And who knows whose action is going to be the one that's going to really bring the world to its perfection, to bring Mashiach, to bring the final Geula. And if we realize the power of our actions, we would do them with much more focus, in a much more, you know, devoted and sincere way, because these actions carry within them so much power, so much influence, and so much potential to change the world and to change history. So the Medrash continues, and it tells us this point in a very, very powerful way. Rabbi Kohen, which is an interesting name, his name was Rabbi Kohen, Rabbi Yeshua de Sechnin, b'shem Rabbi Levi, they said, L'sha'avar, in the past, Haya Adam Ose Mitzvah, somebody would do a mitzvah, V'navi Kosva, and you might find it written in the Navi. You know, Boaz did a mitzvah, and lo and behold, it's right here in the Navi, right? And the Navi would show us that that action you did, you thought was a regular everyday mitzvah, but this actually changed history. That's what Navi shows us. V'achshav, but nowadays, when there's no more Naviim being written, K'sha'adam osim mitzvah, when we do a mitzvah, and Allah did a mitzvah that will change history, Mikosva, who's writing it down? Like, how do we know which actions of ours are really so significant? And the Medrash says, Eliyahu Kosva, Umelcha Mashiach, because Baruch Hu, Umelcha Mashiach, Eliyahu HaNavi, and the Mashiach write it down, and Hashem signs off on it. That's what the Medrash says. Which means that these things are still happening. You know, actions of this significance are still happening. You know, we don't have the privilege right now of having Nevi'im around who can tell us that action is the one. We don't have that. But yet in Shemayim, they're still being recorded. They're just as important. They change history in the same powerful way. We're just unaware of it. And yet, the Mashiach and Eliyahu Navi are recording down, you know, the final book of Tanakh, as it were, with all of our actions that are meaningful for history. And it says Hashem will sign off on that. Hashem signs off on it and says, I'm putting my stamp of approval. These actions are the ones that are significant, that are going to change the course of history. So it's such an incredible lesson for all of us, because we don't realize the power of our actions. Boaz didn't know, and Aaron didn't know, and Reuven didn't know. And had they known, they would have put forth a lot more focus and effort on what they were doing, because they realized this action is not just a one-time nice mitzvah to do, but this is going to change the course of history. We've known in our lives, we may be changing history, and we don't even know it. I'm sure there's thousands of people throughout history that did actions that changed the course of human life, and had no idea they were doing that at the time. And that's up to us to know that our actions are so powerful. And that's when the Medrash begins. Medrash says, when we do a mitzvah, do it with a levav shalem, a full heart. And the lesson being, because you don't know how far that mitzvah can go and what it can do. Yeah.
I can't remember who said, Rabbi Lazar Brody was talking last night, and I mentioned somebody who said, you should do as much, put as much effort into a smaller mitzvah than to a bigger mitzvah, because you don't know what the impact of it's
going to be. Exactly the point. Exactly the point. Right. Right.
Rather, I have two comments. First of all, if he knew she was the progenitor of David HaMelech, he could have given her a big meal. I mean, he knew that, right?
Right.
She might not have known that, but why did he give her this piece of bread with vinegar? Maybe because they were in the field.
Yeah.
I mean, well, how is he going to prepare a big meal in the field?
Right, because said, hold on a minute, we're back.
And, and then if she was hungry, maybe she can't wait for a big meal to be made.
And maybe she could not eat so much.
Even this she left.
I mean, he could have brought it afterwards. I mean, he had servants who could have taken care of it. He could have brought it afterwards. I mean, could have sent her back with a care package to Nami. You know, there are other things he could have done, right? But I think that the important point here was that, you know, this meal that she had, she brought back to Nami these toasted grains.
Uh-huh.
And Nami perceived and said, what's happened? Who'd you go to today? Where'd you get toasted grains from? You're supposed to be collecting leket in the field. Mm-hmm. And then she said, well, I actually ran into Boaz. Oh, Boaz, I know Boaz. And that's what began the story. Mm-hmm. Had Boaz not given her these grains, she came back with wheat. Nami wouldn't have been so curious. You know, oh, here's some wheat. Okay, here's wheat. She's expecting wheat. Then the toasted grains were so important. So had he given her steak, Nami would have been doubly curious. Where'd you get steak from? You know? Yeah.
So essentially what that my reason to quote it is that we're no different from Boaz. Boaz also didn't know that his action was being recorded.
Right.
And Reuven didn't know that his action was being recorded.
Right.
Subsequently was. And our stuff is being recorded. We don't know that. We find out eventually.
Right. Exactly. That's how important our actions are. And then one more part of this pasuk, another lesson. So one pasuk has a lot in it. So it says, "Vatocha, vatisba, vatosar." She ate, she was satisfied, and she had leftover. So we already mentioned that this vatisba was miraculous. There wasn't that much food, but it still satisfied her. It's interesting. But it's also pointed out here, we know that there's different approaches to eating. And you know the famous idea we say in English, you live to eat or eat to live. Mm-hmm. And the way that tzaddik eats, it says in Mishle, it's a tzaddik ochel asova nafsho. A tzaddik eats to satisfy his soul. To satisfaction. So, meaning that somebody who lives life for a higher purpose and doesn't live life for food, so you eat until you're satisfied because you have the nutrition you need, and then you move on. You don't make a big deal out of food. You don't eat more and more and more and overeat and sit around with extra cake and extra cookies because I'm satisfied now. I had enough. I feel good. I feel energized, so I can move on. It says, Rus, she probably was very hungry before this meal because she was poor and she was collecting leket. It says she ate till she batisba, she was satisfied, and there was extra food there. She could have kept on eating. She could have said, oh no, I'm worried about, I'm going to be starving tomorrow, and I haven't eaten in days, and you know, I'm a poor person. But she said, no, I'm satisfied right now. Tzadik ochel silva nafsho, tzadik only eats to be satisfied. And therefore, I'll leave over the rest, and she actually brought back the rest too. Nami is what she did. But it's a lesson in how a righteous person approaches eating. Especially in Rosa's situation, where she was poor and hungry, you would think that to have that type of self-control is a bigger challenge. Many people, unfortunately, when they are hungry, they do eat way too much because they're not used to eating and they're just so happy to have food, they just keep putting it in and it's not healthy for them. The pasuk continues, Beten Rishayim Techsar. So it's a Tzadik Ochel Chosov HaNafsho, that a Tzadik eats to be satisfied. Beten Rishayim Techsar, the stomach of a Rasha, of a wicked person, is lacking. So the simple meaning of this is like it's a curse, that if you're a tzaddik, you get satisfied, and if you're a Rasha, if you're wicked, then Hashem will cause you to lack. But there's actually an interpretation from the Vilna Gaon I mentioned before, it's a funny interpretation, but it actually is very, very powerful. He says, Bet HaMarashayim Techsar means that somebody who is righteous eats till they're satisfied, somebody who is wicked is lacking an extra stomach. But sometimes you wish you had another stomach. Like the food's so good and you're full, but you want to eat more. You know, you ever go to like a wedding, you're at the shmorg, and the food's just so good, but you're just so full already. No, they bring out another dessert. Like, I wish I could eat it, but I'm so full. So the Russia says, I wish I had a spare stomach. What'd you say?
You can always make room.
Yeah. always room for jello. Right? So we're all like that, you know. You wish you had a spare stomach in your pocket so you could eat the extra piece of cake because you like the taste of it so much. But the lesson of Mishle is telling us that, you know, eating is to be satisfied. Eating to give you health and nutrition, and enjoy the food. You should enjoy it very much. But life's not about eating. And to say I want to eat more than my satisfaction is saying that food becomes my focus. Mm-hmm. And I'm living for the food, and that this is my goal, and the food is not just a means to an end. Mm-hmm. So that's what it means, Betim Rishayim Techsar. So our goal should never be the eating. Our goal is to eat to be satisfied. Rusay until she was satisfied. She didn't let the poverty or the hunger overtake her. And we know that both physically and spiritually, it's something which is unhealthy for us to overeat. You know, we know physically if you overeat is unhealthy, and spiritually as well. If you overeat, then you become more connected to the physical and to your food, and you lose the ability to really focus on Hashem and on serving Hashem properly. So it's the idea of going past Sevilla is negative from all ends, in all directions. So the Rus ate till Sevilla, till she was satisfied, Batisba, and then she stopped. She had leftovers, she had more food on the table and said, okay, but I don't need to eat it, I'm full. I had enough, Batosar, she had leftovers.
Did she have leftovers specifically to give to Naomi?
No. I mean, it doesn't sound like it says Batisba. She ate till she was satisfied, and then there happened to be leftovers there. So, I mean, had there not been enough to give to Naomi, she probably would have brought back just the grains, but not the toasted prepared food from Boaz. But there was prepared food here, which was a special, extra special delicacy.
It's too much.
So let's go to verse 15. Then she got up to glean, and Boaz ordered his young men, saying, let her glean even among the sheaves, do not embarrass her. So she leaves this meal, and really she could have said to Boaz, hey, you know, you've given me this great speech, and you've encouraged me, and you've seen my greatness. I'm not going to go out there and collect leket anymore. Can you please give help support me, take care of me? You told me I'm going to be royalty. She could have played that card. But she goes back when nothing happened. She goes back humbly and starts collecting in the field once again. I mean, we don't see her react with any sort of arrogance, any sort of pride. She sees herself, I'm doing what has to be done. You know, that's a wonderful speech I got, very encouraging, but so I'll let Hashem take care of that. If Hashem must make me a king, then that's wonderful. But I'm going to go back and do what I'm supposed to do. And she goes back to the field and begins to glean the sheaves in order to collect the leket. And then, so Boaz tells his young men, don't embarrass her. And it sounds like until now, which the Midrashim point out, they did mistreat her. You know, they made fun of her. You know, she was a Moabite, she was a convert, she was a girl who shouldn't have been in the field because it wasn't common for girls to be out in these fields, apparently. They threw her over the fence, they threw her out of the field. And Boaz said, don't touch her, don't go near her, treat her properly, don't embarrass her. She's a very special woman. So he gave a little of a rebuke to his workers. And then verse 16, even deliberately pull out some for her from the heaps and leave them for her to glean, don't rebuke her. So he tells them, you know, she won't take food from me. We spoke about before how Naomi really could have gone to Boaz's door and just said, please help me out, you know, I'm your cousin, can you please support us? But Naomi and Rus would not take any handouts in any circumstance. So Boaz said, I want to give her more food, but I don't know how to do it. So he told his workers, I want you to plant, you know, leket, pretend that you dropped. Leket means that they've dropped it as they're harvesting. He says, why don't you go ahead and act as if you dropped it, and drop things on purpose so that she will accept it, because otherwise she's stubborn and she won't take any handouts from me. I want to help her out, but I can't. So not only does he tell them to treat her properly and nicely, he says, I want you to purposely drop things on the ground. She'll think it's leket, but really it was done intentionally, and she'll get to glean extra grains. So verse 17. So she gleaned in the field until evening, and she beat out what she had gleaned. It came to be about an ephah of barley. So at the end of the day, she collected an ephah. An ephah is actually a very large sum. It seems to be about 5 days' worth of food for her and the Ami together.
Wow.
So
how much is ephah?
Ephah. I don't know the English amount, but what I saw was that it should be about 5 days of food for both of them. Wow. You know, we could probably do the math, because we know that the man was a siris ephah, a tenth of an ephah. Mm-hmm. And if I got it right, the quantity of dough that we take challah from is the same amount as the man, which is the sirsa ifa. So that's like 5 pounds of flour, right? I'm doing the math right. So multiply that by a lot, you know. So we're talking about a lot of grain. It would have lasted for a while.
Huge amount.
Yeah, would have lasted for a while. So the point being that, you know, both based on her diligence and based on Boaz's kindness in leaving behind, you know, extra leket on purpose. So she actually came back to Naomi with an astounding amount of barley, which really was a very big help for them, because they had nothing. They really had nothing. So it continues and says, she carried it and came to the city. Her mother-in-law saw what she had gleaned, and she took out and gave her what she had left over after her fill. So she came back to Naomi, and Naomi saw how much she had, and she also gave her the The grains, the toasted grains, the prepared food.
So she did give her what she left.
The leftovers, yeah, she did.
She did give
her the leftovers.
Yeah.
So Nami's very curious at this point. Now, Ruth doesn't just come and tell Nami the story. You know, most of us, this happened to us, we'd come home, we'd say, you know what happened today? I met this man, and he told me, it was so exciting, look how much food I got. Ruth comes home and says, here you go, you know, enjoy, I brought him a lot of food for you. So Nami's looking at all this food, especially the prepared food, forget the grains that anybody could collect, but the prepared food, and she says, what's going on over here? Verse 19, she says, where did you glean today? Her mother-in-law asked her, where did you work? May the one that took such generous notice of you be blessed. So she told her mother-in-law whom she had worked by, and said, the name of the man by whom I work today is Boaz. Right. So the finally, Ruth tells her the story. And says, by the way, the guy's name is Boaz. I mean, Ruth doesn't recognize the connection. She doesn't know that Boaz is actually a family member of Naomi. But only because Naomi saw it. The different commentaries say Naomi was concerned. How'd she get so much food?
Mm-hmm.
And where did the prepared food come from? Is somebody taking advantage of her? Did she steal it? Did she make some sort of deal which is going to come back and backfire against us? I mean, it was very strange. It was out of the ordinary she had all this. What?
She didn't trust her?
I mean, until now she did, but, you know, this is a very strange situation over here. I mean, she's a Moabite. You know, she doesn't really know exactly what she happened today. It's very astonishing what she came back with. There's something out of the ordinary. It's very surprising.
You mean, Rabbi, this is the time of the barley harvest, right?
Yeah.
So that's more Pesach time.
Yes.
Isn't Shavuos the wheat harvest?
Yeah, correct.
So even though it didn't happen Shavuos time, we still read it Shavuos.
Right. Well, at the end of the parak, it says she stayed there until the wheat harvest as well. So it does overlap Shavuos.
Okay.
It does overlap.
So it started at the
it started Pesach at Pesach time, but it continues on through Shavuos time. Yeah. But Nami is very, very curious about where did you get all this leket, and who gave you the toasted grain, and what are you doing out there? Did somebody take advantage of you? Did you make some sort of deal which is going to come back and haunt us at the end? And Ruth tells her the whole story at this point and says the guy's name is Boaz. So Nami hears that. She's like, Boaz. You know, and to her this was a striking moment. But before we get to that, I saw another beautiful thought on this pasuk. The terminology used is in Hebrew, it says Tomer Shim Ishar Asisi Imo. The man that I worked for, Ashar Asa Imo. It's the one who I did for him. And it's a funny term because she wasn't doing anything for him. Mm-hmm. She was collecting for herself.
Mm-hmm.
She was there picking up. What?
Isn't it with him?
Even so, for him or with him. I guess Emo would be with him. But even so, I worked for today. When I worked Emo, I worked with him. I didn't work with him. I worked for myself.
Just
right?
She had worked by you.
Right. So the question is, what do you mean I worked for him or with him? Like, what exactly does that mean? She was there for herself collecting the gifts to the poor, the leket. And anybody has the right to collect leket. That doesn't help the owner of the field if you collect his leket. It doesn't do any good for him. I mean, I guess he does a mitzvah. But what exactly is she describing here? And on this we have a quote from the Gemara. It says, Yoser mashbal bayis osim ani. More than the master does for the poor person, ha'ani osa imbal habayis. The poor person does for the master.
Yeah.
We have this also when it comes to a guest. You know, more than the host does for the guest. The guest does for the host. You have the terms like this a lot throughout the Gemara. But the point being, you know, we think that if we give tzedakah, we're doing a lot for the poor person, and we are. But the truth is, the merit that gives us goes far beyond the dollars we gave that poor person.
Mm-hmm.
The amount of mitzvahs the Torah gives in regards to how to treat an ani, how to give tzedakah, how to treat our money, there are many of them. And the brachas the Torah guarantees, the blessing for us that the Torah guarantees for doing these mitzvahs are bountiful blessings. Very, very powerful, strong blessings. And the ani walks away with, you know, a few dollars, even a large donation. But I gain much more out of giving that money because I fulfilled all these mitzvahs. I've grown, I've become more generous, more kind, less materialistic. And I've racked up so many mitzvos in heaven that it goes far beyond any dollar amount I could put on the money I gave to the ani. So you see here this reference, Asisi Imo, I worked for him, I worked with him. Really the ani is working for us because I give to the ani, but yet what they're actually doing is doing so much more for us. That opportunity which is there is tremendous. I've quoted before, we spoke at Tzedakah here a few months ago, I'll quote it again. There's a very often quoted passage from the Zohar. And the Zohar says that sometimes up in heaven, they're judging a person. And they say, this person, you know, he or she is, you know, 50-50. I don't know what to do with them. So Hashem says, let me give them a chance to tilt the scales. I'm going to send somebody poor to their door, and we'll see how they react. So Dani knocks at the door, and that's your chance. You know, you're 50-50 right now. So Hashem says, if you make the right choice, then you're going to tilt the scale in your favor. If not, then God forbid the other way. But that only was a gift to us, to give us tremendous merit up in heaven in order so that we can tilt the scales in our favor. And it's like that all the time. The amount of reward, the amount of blessing that comes from giving out tzedakah properly is a tremendous amount. So we really can look at it that the ani works for us, right? They're doing for us, to our advantage. Yeah.
Okay, so Rabbi Schaefer, he has a schmoozing, he talks about this one line. He says, well, this is kind of rude for her to say, well, you know, I helped him because he gave tzedakah. So he says, but it's really talking about, it hurts her self-esteem because she was royalty.
Uh-huh.
And so she feels bad that here she was royalty, now she's picking up the lacket. And so in order for
so
her...
So she needs her own self-esteem. She has to put it in a more positive way.
Interesting. Mind, she was helping him. Feel
interesting. So that's a different approach to it. Yeah, very interesting. Very interesting. Because she feels that royalty within. Interesting. She was royalty from before. So, interesting.
It's
okay.
Like this is damaging to her.
Right. I understand that. Interesting. So that is the idea of working with him or for him.
Okay.
Let's work at. Let's do a little bit more. Verse 1.
Let's finish the paragraph.
We'll see. We'll see what we could do. But let's do verse 20. Verse 20. Yeah. Naomi said to her daughter-in-law, "Blessed be he of Hashem for not failing in his kindness to living or the dead. The man is closely related to us." Naomi then said to her, "He is one of our redeeming kinsmen." So Naomi understands who Boaz is. And Naomi immediately sees the Hashkacha, divine providence, in this entire story. She says, "Do you know who this person was? This person is a cousin of ours, and of her late husband as well, and he's somebody who could really redeem us and take our situation and put us back on the right track. That's what he can do." So Naomi is very excited about this, and we'll see in the next chapter how she actually reacts to it. Verse 21, "And Ruth the Moabite said, 'What's more, he even said to me, stay close to my workers until they have finished all my harvest.'" So there's two interesting things in this pasuk. Number one is that Ruth, we'll call three things. Ruth says, number one, that it's not just a one-day thing. He said, stick with me for the whole harvest. So we're set. She feels a confidence that I have a place to go for the entire duration of the harvest. He'll take care of us. And we have a security now. But there's two curious things in this verse. Number one is she's called here Ruth the Moabite. We haven't used that term in a while in the Megillah. Number two, it's lost in the English translation. If you look at the Hebrew, it says, "Ki amar elai imha ne'arim asher li tidbakin." He said to me, "You should stick with ne'arim, with the male workers." Now, if you look back at verse 8, what he actually told her was the ne'aros, the female workers. Mm-hmm. And when Ruth awaits this to Naomi, she actually says ne'arim, the male workers.
Yeah.
It's a very strange thing. And many commentaries struggle with why did she report this fact seemingly inaccurately. So the Medrash points this out. And the Medrash takes both of these different curious points of the Pasuk and says that they actually are there together for a reason. And it's because she was a Moabite, because she has Moabite roots, that's why she mentioned the males, not the females. Mm-hmm. Meaning what? That Boaz was sticking to very, very high moral standards. He says, amongst Jews, we keep the men and the women separate. We don't want you to mingle unless it's the right time and the right place. Ruth, being that she came from Moabite background, even though she's a righteous convert at this point, she didn't fully perceive that. In her mind, men and women mingled. Mm-hmm. So he said the aros, but for her, that word did not necessarily ring in her mind that only the ladies. It meant all the workers, because she wasn't used to those standards that Jews keep to. And therefore, she reported it back. She didn't do this in any malicious way, but she reported back. For her, it wasn't a meaningful statement, even though Rosai, because she didn't understand, at least she didn't feel deep down, those are the standards that she had to keep to. Mm-hmm. Now, she committed to those standards, as we spoke about a few weeks ago, but just in her mind, that attitude was still there. And there's an important lesson from this, which is that even though Rus had gone through so much and devoted herself to Judaism and become a righteous convert, there was still a Moabite within. Mm-hmm. Where the standards of Judaism were not yet there. And the reason is because, you know, all of us are so influenced by what we're taught as children. Everybody. you know, we absorb the values we absorb when we're young, even if we realize they may be incorrect values, they're very, very hard to shirk in older age. And even though she has already declared to the Ami, as we said, in a very, very definite way that I'm committed to Torah and all those Torah standards and the standards of modesty and halacha and everything else, that doesn't necessarily erase deep down the values she's taught as a kid. And even though, obviously, Rus is somebody who's very modest and very tzinuan, she stayed away from all the young men. We saw it in the entire description. But deep down, those feelings were still within, and they're very hard sometimes to uproot. It's something that we struggle with also, because everybody as kids is taught certain things, and then as we go older, we learn different things. And those things that for us were kind of axiomatic as children, these are the principles we were taught, the values we were taught, sometimes we need to reconsider them, and we have to change them, erase them, reform those things we were taught as children. And it's very hard to do, because if this is what I grew up with for the first 10, 15, 20 years of my life, this is what, so then it's very hard to change those values. It's based on family, based on society, but what you're taught as a kid really sticks. The Gemara talks about something called Girsa de Yankusa. Mm-hmm. It's the learning of a child. Mm-hmm. And we know that what children are taught, it really sticks within. And even as you grow older, those things remain with us, for better or for worse. So we utilize it for the best, that the kids, they really absorb so much as children, and that information really becomes part of who they are. But sometimes we absorb things that are incorrect, and then it's very hard to change those ideas. Even though we tell ourselves that's wrong, deep down it's always there. So Rus over here, it came out kind of in a subliminal message. She didn't mean anything bad by saying Ne'arim, but Chazal picked up on that, and they showed us that deep down there was still a Moabite within. It's most stuff. Everyone have a good Yom Tov.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. I think being that we only have two more classes left until the summer, maybe we'll continue with Rus just through the summer. Just because it's only 2 weeks anyways. Okay, so try to do more. Okay.